This is The Guardian.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
This week, the government told us once again that there's no more money.
We will do what is necessary for as long as necessary to tackle inflation persistence and bring it back to the 2% target.
Slightly more surprisingly, or maybe unsurprisingly, the Labour Party seems to be echoing the same message.
All of our plans will be built on a rock of economic and fiscal responsibility. Labour will not play fast and loose with the public finances.
So have we reached a place where the politics of hope is all over? I'm John Harris and you're listening to Politics Week the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are the former Conservative Minister and in fact Chief Secretary to the Treasury, David Gawk, and The Guardian's Gabby Hinsliff. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
The message over recent days from both the two main Westminster parties seems to be that when it comes to money, there isn't any. Equally, that inflation is now so the main priority, the idea of controlling inflation, that everything, including public spending and tax cuts, has to really take second or third place to that. Let's have a listen to what the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, said in his Mansion House speech on Monday.
Working with the bank, we will do what is necessary for as long as necessary to tackle inflation persistence and bring it back to the 2% target. Delivering sound money is our number one focus. That means taking responsible decisions on public finances, including public sector pay, because more borrowing is itself inflationary.
As public sector workers carry on striking for better pay, another teachers' union has announced it's going to be taking strike action on the day we recorded this. And they're striking, let's not forget, also to address funding for the services they work in. Reports this week say that the Treasury won't be funding a recommended 6% wage increase. Instead, the government will be asking departments to find savings themselves. Now, we're recording this on Wednesday. It's said that Rishi Sunak, upon his return to London, is going to make a final decision about this. I wonder what's at stake for the government here? Because clearly, if they're going to insist on these pay increases being unfunded, that then entails the prospect of strikes going on until and after the next election. Is that something they want? You know, is that a convenient political enemy to define themselves against? Or is this a hell of a hostage to fortune? David, what do you think?
All the choices for the government are dreadful. That's the reality here. So they could just kind of go ahead with the pay review recommendations and find additional money. But that's a fiscal loosening. That's putting more money into the economy at the time when the Bank of England is trying to sort of tighten things up. So probably interest rates have to go up a little bit higher than they would otherwise do. Or they could say, yes, we'll accept the pay recommendations, but try to find money from within budgets. But it's not clear if that is at all deliverable. You know, I think there's got to be big question marks about that. Or they can reject the pay review bodies, which is very uncomfortable given the emphasis that was placed on the pay review body recommendations previously.
Yeah, sacrosanct.
Absolutely. Yeah, and as you say, likely to lead to industrial action. And also, and I think this is perhaps the most important point here, the public sector pay is increasingly becoming uncompetitive. because private sector pay is growing pretty strongly at the moment, at least relatively, and it's hard to recruit and retain staff in the public sector. So if you want to deliver public services at a level that is acceptable, you know, you need to pay the staff to have it. So all the choices are great. I don't think this is a fight they're kind of relishing. This is this is the opportunity to we'll take on the unions. They're left with three very difficult choices. By the way, choices that any incoming Labour government will also have after the next election.
What would you do?
I think they need to meet the pay review recommendations, but they can't afford to go and borrow more, and they're going to have to raise additional revenue. And that's a really tough one, but that means putting up taxes.
Ah, you'd put up taxes. So you would put up taxes so as to avoid further cuts to education, health, etc.
I would. I should also add, I'm not looking to be re-elected as a Conservative government. But if I was looking at this purely from what is the right policy response, actually, I share their concerns about inflation and fiscal loosening. To me, that the issue is much more about borrowing more than it is about a higher pay increase, because it's still the case that public sector pay is lagging behind private sector pay.
Do you think, Gabby, the prospect of continuing strikes will look like further proof of this government's inexorable decline, or could they use it to their advantage? I mean, it's not like Conservative governments haven't used strikes to their advantage in the past.
I think it's really difficult to convince people that your hospital appointment being scrapped because the doctors are on strike is like massively a bonus and sign that, you know, things are going very well, or the fact that, yeah, again, you've got to take time off work because your kids can't go to school, you know, or the trains aren't running. These are not things that people are sitting back and thanking the government for at the moment. So I think I did wonder for a long time whether government was just sort of sitting back and hoping to starve people out, essentially, that, you know, it's expensive for public sector workers to strike, that it's costing them money at a time when money's tight for everyone, where they sort of hoping that the strikes would fizzle out a bit. But that doesn't, although there's some evidence of, you know, decreased willingness to strike as the strikes go on, I don't think it's kind of, you know, falling apart. I mean, what the argument that the money has to be found from within budget also does, apart from all things you've mentioned, is it puts the unions and the staff in a very difficult place. If you take the pay rise as a teacher, are you essentially accepting that the money for that is going to come out of your school budget?
They won't. I mean, I spoke to two or three striking teachers about a week or 10 days ago for a piece I was writing for The Guardian, and all of them said exactly that. There was no way they would accept a pay increase knowing that to do so would mean less teaching assistants, less study materials, less school trips, less buildings maintenance, etc.
And I think that for some union, I mean, I don't even know that the NHS strikes are going to be settled by accepting the pay review body. I mean, there's such a big gap between what they're asking for and what pay review recommendations are. So it's not even as simple as, you know, offer everyone 6.5% or whatever it is and get away with it.
Yeah, and that's in the midst of this general picture of extremely tight public finances and the idea that public borrowing is rendered even more problematic because of interest rates and what life is like in the slipstream of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. I mean, the idea that more cuts and pain are coming down the line is not exactly news. Jeremy Hunt was quite explicit about that in the autumn statement last year. And we're starting to see signs of the full-throated return of austerity, if it ever went away. I mean, personally, I don't think it ever went away. But what all that really puts in my mind is this sort of grim sense of the circularity now of the story of the Conservative Party in power. You know, we had Osborneomics and all those years of austerity. Then we got Theresa May and Boris Johnson and Levelling Up and Build Back Better and all those post-Brexit promises. And now we're back to tighten your belts. Fiscal conservatism, if it hurts, it works. That's quite a journey you have been on, David, isn't it?
The grim reality is that we are poorer as a country than we thought we were. And that happened after the global financial crisis. And it's happening now, combination of Brexit, COVID, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We are poorer. You know, our prospects have been diminished. And we can have a debate about whose fault it is, but that is the reality. And, you know, what we can afford to spend on public services and what we have to collect in tax has got to reflect those underlying economic realities. And that's a pretty grim sort of situation that we're in. And either, you know, if that's where we are, either parties got to come forward with a credible plan to increase economic growth. But they're going to have to be careful about, you know, what levers they pull there in terms of fiscal levers, or we're going to have to kind of adjust to that new situation. You know, we can afford to spend what we can afford to spend,
or not spend, right?
Yeah,
Because the point there is, I think you and I have had good-natured disagreements about this in the past.
I think we
it's
have.
About whether there's anything left to cut. I mean, I don't think there is. As you said, there are huge crises of so-called recruitment and retention in schools and hospitals. The state of buildings in the public sector is very often awful. We all know about potholes in the road, bin collections, what's happening to very, very important local services because councils haven't got any money. The idea of another 2010-esque round of austerity, I think, is unthinkable. Is your point that it's not really unthinkable and in the end that might be the medicine we have to swallow?
Well, I mean, partly, let's find an area of agreement, John, is we are in a different situation.
They're always good.
We are in a different situation than we were in 2010. So in 2010, you know, public sector pay for the previous few years had been going up by more than private sector pay, which had been badly hit by the global financial crisis. So there was some opportunity there, if you like. The public's spending had grown very rapidly in the years up to 2010. There was more scope. And I think it's harder now. But you are still faced with the sort of reality, a country that is poorer than it thought it was, you know, that is partly going to be reflected in the quality of public services that we have. That's the grim reality.
Now, I think there's a trap there, isn't there, that we always fall into thinking of austerity as being spending cuts. Actually, austerity means balancing the gap between what you're bringing in and what you're spending. You can do it via spending cuts. You can do it via tax rises. You know, that is the other way round to do it. I mean, other than that, it is just looking at the sort of big areas of spending that I think Conservatives would probably rather die than cut now, which is things like triple lock on pensions. I mean, that is starting to look seriously unaffordable.
I agree.
Now, but nobody wants to say that going into an election, so I guess we won't say that. But, you know, that is on the table. There isn't just the sort of 2010 Osborne way of deciding to live within your means. There are other ways of deciding to live within your means where you distribute the pain a bit more fairly, frankly.
It's a grim feeling, though, isn't it? That sense that cuts and so-called economies, and some of that talk about, oh, efficiency savings and back office, and we all know where that goes, particularly when there's nothing left to cut, that's back in the air.
Yeah, it is depressing. And it's also, I think it's, in a way, like, without wishing to, like, plunge everyone listening into a sort of sense of utter gloom.
That's
it's what we do every week.
You know, your daily misery hour. It's harder than in 2010, both for the reasons that you know, they've just said, which is, you know, we're not coming off a high, but also you're simultaneously dealing with inflation. I mean, at least in 2010, the argument was meant to be, you know, we cut back now and then we unleash rampant growth from somewhere that we then use to kind of, you know, to pick ourselves back up again. Not that anyone's exactly got a recipe for achieving rampant growth now, but if you had, you'd be worried that it would be inflationary.
Yeah,
and you'd be worried that actually you were trying to go in the other direction now. You know, there's an extra problem in the mix that you didn't have in 2010. Okay.
Now, while some sort of liberal bleeding hearts quite rightly worry about spending restraint and cuts and austerity, there is a sort of parallel anxiety on the Conservative side, which is about the mounting impossibility of the tax cuts they would have liked the government to bring in before the next election. I mean, that's toast now, which is another sign, isn't it, of the weakness of Rishi Sunak and the fragility of this government as far as, you know, the opinions of its backbenchers are concerned. That's another thing that's in the air, David.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always been pie in the sky, in my view, that they were going to be able to deliver big tax cuts in this parliament. You know, you look at, as you mentioned earlier, what Jeremy Hunt said in his autumn statement. You look at the spending plans after the next general election, which are very, very tight. The idea that there's scope in the public finances in a sustainable way to have big tax cuts, I think, has always been unrealistic. And yeah, that promise was there to try to sort of pacify the sort of Trussite end of the Conservative Party. But they're still there. And even though the Truss-Kwarteng experiment collapsed catastrophically, very, very quickly, you're still hearing the voices of, oh, we should have given it a go, you know, Blobonomics is not working. And I
real trust has never been tried.
Yes. Okay, it was tried, but it wasn't persisted with. The Conservative Party is behind Rishi Sunak to the next general election, but if it goes wrong, then you'll start to hear the arguments of only we delivered tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera.
And so, Gabby, what is likely to be their pitch to the electorate? This comes down to Rishi Sunak's equally fragile five pledges, which he probably isn't going to make. One of which, let's not forget, was to, I can't remember, halve inflation by Christmas or something stupid.
Yeah, that's kind of not happening. Stopping small boats is kind of not happening. Yeah, yeah, it's not looking great. I mean, his best hope is that people can't remember what the five pledges are and therefore can't remember that they haven't happened, I suppose. But if you think most elections come down to a choice between, like, the opposition's always, time for a change, you know, they've screwed it all up, let us in. And the best incarnation argument is, you know, don't let them ruin all the good work we've achieved so far. You know, and that is not a powerful argument from the Conservative. But
one.
Don't let them ruin this sort of crater in which we find ourselves, this apocalyptic wasteland. If you look at what the Bank of England was saying on Wednesday about, you know, the expectations for mortgages, people are looking at paying, what is it, an average £500 a month more, they're saying, by 2025.
Yeah, yeah.
Over a year, that's going to feel like, what, 8 grand, 10 grand pay cut to
people?
Yeah. That is huge.
Of course. They are the wages.
No tax cut is going to make up for that. Even if you suddenly decided that you could find a tax cut, you're still going to feel worse off.
Yeah, yeah. The politics of what Harold Macmillan originally called the property-owning democracy, a phrase Margaret Thatcher was very fond of, are going to come and bite them, unquestionably. Anyway, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll look on the other side of the House of Commons at the Labour Party and whether we might be in a time on both right and left when hope is something we're going to have to give up looking for.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back. We're going to talk now, or try to, about something that is linked to a lot of what we were discussing in part one. What politics on both the Conservative and Labour sides is offering in the midst of the ever-increasing doom and gloom of the UK's economic climate, and why, across both parties, there is an emphasis on spending restraint and fiscal rectitude, and perhaps as a consequence, no real message of hope. Let's talk about the Labour Party first of all. Wes Streeting, the fast-rising, inescapable shadow health secretary, had a comment piece in The Observer last weekend in which he said, and I quote, "We are being so careful to only make promises we know we can keep. The only thing worse than no hope is false hope. It will disappoint some of our friends that we are not pledging support for every cause they believe in." There's your slogan for Labour Party conference in the autumn, incidentally. No hope, not false hope, which I think has a certain ring to it. It seems that the Labour Party really is terrified of the same things it was terrified of when the coalition was back in power. The idea that the Labour Party, left to its own devices, will spend money it hasn't got. And I suppose the mess Liz Truss made is the sort of newest justification for that position. But doesn't that lead, I wonder, to a sense that their platform, their policy platform, is becoming increasingly empty? This is what Rachel Reeves said to Laura Kunzberg last Sunday about all this.
"All of our plans will be built on a rock of economic and fiscal responsibility. Labour will not play fast and loose with the public finances, because the people who pay the price for that are people who own their own homes, who wish to own their own homes, people running small businesses who have been terribly affected by the turbulence in the economy, the increases in mortgage rates, the increases in prices in the shops. We will never put family finances at risk."
Broadly speaking, I don't think, you know, the Labour Party is going to wildly diverge from this line that we're going to get all the way up to the election, which is going to be, we have to be careful, we have to be prudent, times are tough, there's not any money, sorry, we have to say no. You know, there's a lot of that all the way to the election. And I think one of the reasons for it, miserable as it is that the economic fundamentals by the time the election happens are not going to be vastly different, probably, than they are now. They may be worse than they are now. Labour's always terrified of saying before it takes power, you know, that they're going to spend any money. And what they've done in the past is kind of take power saying we're terribly, terribly, terribly responsible, and then a couple of years in start spending money. And that may be the plan this time around. But I think there's a second sort of corollary this time around, which isn't just worrying what the voters will think about you. It's worrying what the markets will think about you. It's worrying that promising, you know, large amounts of borrowing is going to spook the markets all over again, and Britain's already assumed to be a basket case and blah, 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 blah. I think there are sound economic reasons for being as cautious as they are, but it's miserable and depressing to listen to. I think most Labour voters will go into the ballot box hoping that they don't mean it, hoping, as I'm sure the Labour front bench is, that, you know, a couple of years in things will look different and they start to spend, or they start to say things that they're scared to say now. But, you know, that's a gamble to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, and the proof of some of this is very, very direct, you know. I get the sense sometimes that the Labour Party now is increasingly sort of running against where it was about 18 months ago, you know, the £28 billion a year Green Prosperity Pledge, which was the sort of centrepiece thing of its last party conference, has now been postponed and diluted. And who knows when that's going to arrive? That's one obvious example.
They're running against, as much as anything, what they're running against is the 2019 manifesto, because there's inevitably, so every time they announce, you know, that manifesto, most of it has been, you know, large parts of it have been junked. Large parts of it, I'm sure, are still to be junked. So, you know, that means every time they make any announcement of any policy, the instant response is, oh, does this mean you're not going to do X that you were going to do before? Do you mean you're not going to? There's going to be a constant process of dropping and ditching and disappointing. But the trouble is that's fine if what you're saying instead is eye-catching and exciting, and you think, well, it's fine that we're not doing that anymore because this is really interesting. But when it's kind of along the lines of, I mean, I don't have anything against oracy in schools, you know, I think it's great, let's all do public speaking, but it's not revolutionary, is it?
Yeah, it's thin gruel by comparison. Dispassionately, David, as a sort of observer of politics, do you think that's the danger of where the Labour Party is? That it just sounds like it issues a no every week, and I'm still wondering what the yeses are?
Yeah, it is the risk. But again, you know, what are the other options? I mean, look, I'm perhaps, as a former Treasury minister, my sympathies are with Rachel Reeves in putting out a kind of tough message, because, as I was saying earlier, these are kind of the realities. And you know, she, and again, this reminds me a little bit of sort of 2010. You've got the task of winning the election, and you know, you want to reassure the markets as well, but you know, also the electorate. And Labour does have an electoral weakness in being seen as irresponsible with the public finances. So you know, opposition is very often about reassurance, but you then also got to be thinking about, well, look, if we're going to win the election, are we going to be able to function as a government? And you do need to start working now on expectations, because there's going to be a lot of people who will vote Labour in the hope that, you know, austerity is behind us, you can turn the taps on, you know, public sector pay is going to go up, it's going to be great, it's going to be like the early 2000s, and, you know, it's all going to be hunky-dory. And the reality is that that's not what the next Labour government is going to be in a position to deliver. It's going to be pretty tough. I think the real political difficulty will come halfway through a Labour government, where people are saying, well, you know, what's the point of a Labour government? You're not doing anything very different.
But if hope is lacking from a centre-left party, these centre-left parties pitched to the electorate in such dreadful economic times, then politics, in terms of how much it engages people, is in a mess, isn't it?
It is. But what you're looking for, what the 97 government was very good at doing, was coming up with sort of cost-free ways of sounding hopeful. Like, we're going to have an ethical foreign policy. I mean, we all know what happened to that later. But, you know, it wasn't an expensive... It wasn't expensive.
Symbolic social democratic things. We get rid of this and therefore that pays for that, right? So we get rid of the assisted places scheme and it shrinks class sizes, you know. We bring in the windfall tax and we put young people back to work.
The one thing that Labour did get into trouble with in 1997 was health, because in other kind of departments, you could say, you know, we'll have a big defence review about what we should spend money on. That gets us over the sort of 2 years where we're not really spending anything. But on health, people really wanted something instantly to happen to the NHS, and it didn't. And tempers were really, really fraying by the end of that sort of first 2 years, because there's not much that you can say that sounds exciting but doesn't deliver in health. In other departments, it's easier. You know, you can see Wes Streeting is starting to talk up reform instead of, you know, money. Okay, you know, there are things you can say, there are things you can do, but they're not, you can't get out at the end of the day from the fact that public services are really underfunded and need more money.
Yeah, yeah. But if you end up saying false hope is worse than no hope, right? You're in a bad political place, I would argue. If that's the loudest thing you've got to say, right? That points up a severe set of absences in your politics, doesn't it?
Ideally, that sentence should then go, but here yes, are the things we can be hopeful about. You know, just, well, tough, that's it.
Tough, that's what it sounds like. Yeah, David, anyway.
Two things. One is, you know, there is quite a sizable bit of the electorate that might respond well to some honesty. I mean, I'm conscious that there'll be others who won't, but you know, you can win some respect, and it's much easier to do from opposition than in government when you've been in power for a long time. So there is that point. The second point I would make is, yeah, if they can find other things to sort of say, where, look, this is what we're going to do to deliver growth that is not expensive. So, you know, I think the fact that the Conservatives have vacated planning reform as an issue is a bit of an opening for Labour, which they are exploiting. The other very obvious one, which is our relationship with the European Union. And I do, you know, let's not reopen that whole issue today. But
sound of Keir Starmer running out of the room in fear.
Well, quite. But you can see how a Labour government will be under increased pressure to kind of go further on Brexit, because, you know, there is a line of something that you could do that is actually cheap. It's economically, fiscally cost free, and something that could bring higher levels of growth. And you know, I've long been of the view that argument will really pick up after a Labour government is elected.
Yeah, not this side of the election.
The other thing that I wish they'd come back to is actually something that David Cameron picked up as an argument in 2010, which is this whole concept of general well-being. You know, what is there? Are there things you could do for the gen that improve qualities of people's lives, that make people happier, that don't necessarily involve spending vast amounts of money? And you don't...
Well, wouldn't that sound absurd? You'd say, well, that's very nice, but my school's falling down. I can't get an appointment with the GP. The roads are riddled with potholes, and my elderly relative social care package has been cut to a 10-minute visit once a fortnight.
And yet, I mean? Your alternative is saying, I'm not doing anything about any of those things, and just don't come back to me for 2 years. So I think in the meantime, you
no hope's better than false hope. See?
You have to be talking about something. And I think, you know, to just be able to offer nothing is a situation that no political party wants to be in.
There is a bigger issue here in conclusion, it seems to me, which is that everybody knows that in all sorts of ways, this country is in an awful mess and has probably hit a variety of dead ends, right? And those things have happened in the past. You can make the argument that that was the case in 1979. So this isn't an argument about a solely left-wing definition of hope. For a lot of voters, when Margaret Thatcher came along in 1979, she was offering hope. She said, I'm going to get this country out of this mess. And eventually she did this, 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 and this. And as far as a lot of people thought, that's what she did. I, by contrast, think, as I said a moment ago, that what's remarkable about politics now, on the Conservative and Labour sides, is there is no message of things can be better than this, and if you vote for us, we are going to get us out of this mess. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like, well, I'm sorry, we're competent and we'll do better at the execution of power than the other lot, but really the pain is going to carry on for quite a while. And that seems to be it. And I think if you're in that state, there's an argument for saying that democracy itself has sort of failed, really. If you're not offering hope, which is the most basic currency of politics, I don't really know where you are.
Well, you're not offering answers. That's the trouble. It's not just hope. It's that you have answers to the problems. I get the sense more strongly than I ever have, actually, now, that on the sort of really big questions, people don't know. It's not that there's an answer out there that no one's just lit on yet, but there is a brilliant solution that will, you know, solve all our problems and miraculously transform us back to growth. It's not that there is one, but people think it's too expensive or too difficult or the voters won't like it. It's that genuinely nobody knows.
It's going to be an underwhelming election, Gabby, isn't it?
I really hope that's not the case, but I really fear that's the case. And I think I've probably reached the stage in the electoral cycle where you start looking outside this country really for optimistic signs. You know, you kind of look, America, the US has got inflation coming down to its lowest in God knows how many years now. You know, European economies seem to be performing better than ours. You can see signs of sort of hope or signs of people doing things differently, ambitiously and radically all around the world. You just can't see it here.
Yeah.
And that is the one thing that cheers me up, is you think, okay, other countries will find a way through this. Eventually, presumably, we might learn something from them. But clearly, that's going to be a extremely long, drawn-out process.
Well, it's a really cheery thought on which to close. The point is that if you don't deliver a message of hope, and I don't necessarily mean that solely in terms of policy, I am talking about rhetoric and story and all those things, which in the end are what probably gets voters chiefly to put their cross in a particular box. If those things are missing, you leave a gap then, potentially, for very, very unpleasant forces to fill, right? And that's part of the story of Brexit, let's not forget, is a lot of people who felt that politics, mainstream politics, had nothing to offer compared to the often awful reality of their lives, and therefore they voted to just upturn the monopoly board, and we all know what happened. And I worry that in the midst of this absence of hope, we might be moving into similarly dangerous waters. David, you were nodding.
I fear you're right on this, John. So I mean, as far as I can see, we assume Labour will win the next election. But as we've talked about, it's going to be a pretty tough time. And I don't think that there's some lever to pull that is going to be completely transformative. And that is going to be an opportunity for both the populist right and the populist left. To some extent, I think my argument is that centrists need to be prepared to kind of go out and make arguments that, the government's kind of got this right, but it needs to go further and faster on this, on the things that can deliver economic growth.
Gabby, can you say anything to cheer us up in the minute or two we have left? Happy talk. Keep talking.
I am slightly racking my brains. The only thing that it's more of a long-term horizontal thing, but the only thing cheers me up is thinking back to, I mean, I was born in the 70s when everything was rubbish, middle of an oil shock, everything was disastrous. We were all going to hell in a handcart, and then I kind of hit my 20s in the 90s when suddenly, that just happened to be, the perfect time to be 20 years old. And my parents were born in the middle of the war when it was a ridiculous mad time to have a baby and literally, an apocalyptic time to grow up, and then managed to be young in the 60s, which was fantastic. And you look for and think, okay, maybe it's 20 years from now, but everything is cyclical. Everything comes around eventually. I know this sounds like I'm saying that you have to wait 20 years to be in any way cheered up compared to where we are now, but that's probably the best I can do.
That's a great message
to
go out on.
Eventually all things pass, just eventually.
You heard it here first on Politics Weekly UK.
2040s are going to be amazing.
We're going to have a great time in our 70s. Yeah,
we'll see you in the sunlit uplands of 2043. Join us then. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to the next 20 years of Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts, and even better, leave us a review, preferably a nice one. We'll be back next week. We'll also be here in the 2040s when everything is going to be great. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kikoutier, and the executive producers of Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson. I'm out of here. I'm taking early retirement. Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.